Good evening. It's 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. You are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Trump calls for depriving immigrants who illegally cross border of due process rights. The president has decided that the 5th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution no longer apply to immigrants in this country. Both amendments say no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Trump says those who cross into the United States illegally should be sent back immediately without due process or an appearance before a judge. The Bill of Rights applies to everyone, even illegal immigrants. So an immigrant, legal or illegal, prosecuted under the criminal code has the right to due process. But it is important. Immigration proceedings are matters of administrative law, not criminal law, and Congress has nearly full authority to regulate immigration without interference from the courts. Trump's call to ignore due process faces both constitutional questions and dissension from within his own party. Republicans in Congress, some of whom have insisted that the number of judges be increased, not decreased, so migrant families can have their cases heard more quickly. Federal immigration courts faced a backlog of more than 700,000 cases in May, and cases can take months or years to be heard. According to data from the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University, the immigration court's backlog keeps rising. As of the end of May 2018, the number of cases waiting decision reached an all-time high of 714,067. This compares with a court backlog of 542,411 cases at the end of January of last year when Trump assumed office. During his term, the backlog was increased by almost a third, or 32%, with 171,656 cases added. It's noteworthy that the pace of court filings has not increased. Indeed, filings are running slightly behind that of last year at this time. Instead, what appears to be driving the burgeoning backlog is the lengthening time it now takes to schedule hearings and complete proceedings in the face of the court's overcrowded dockets. While the Justice Department, including Attorney General Sessions and court administrators, have implemented a number of new policies with the announced aim of speeding case dispositions, their efforts thus far have not had the desired result and appear to have actually lengthened completion times so that these new cases have risen to an all-time high. Supreme Court just ruled against warrantless cell phone tracking. Score one for the Constitution. Quote, the government can no longer claim that just using technology like your cell phones means you've given up your Fourth Amendment rights, end quote, says the ACLU. In a decision that digital rights advocates called a groundbreaking victory for Americans' privacy rights, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Friday that police generally must obtain a warrant before collecting cell phone records that can be used to track a person's movements. The ACLU, which represented the petitioner, predicted the historic win will have a ripple effect for privacy, particularly as it applies to data held by third parties. Quote, we decline to grant the state unrestricted access to a wireless caller's database or physical location information, end quote, according to Chief Justice John Roberts. He wrote this for the majority opinion. The 5-4 ruling will protect deeply revealing records associated with 400 million devices, the Chief Justice wrote. It did not matter, he wrote, that the records were in the hands of a third party. That aspect of the ruling was a significant break from earlier decisions. The Constitution must take account of vast technological changes, Chief Justice Roberts wrote, noting that digital data can provide a comprehensive, detailed, and intrusive overview of private affairs that would have been impossible to imagine not long ago. The decision made exceptions for emergencies like bomb threats and child abductions, such exigencies, he wrote, include the need to pursue a fleeing suspect, protect individuals who are threatened with imminent harm, or prevent the imminent destruction of evidence. In general, though, the authorities must now seek a warrant for cell tower location information, and the logic of the decision suggests other kinds of digital data that provide a detailed look at a person's private life. The decision thus has implications for all kinds of personal information held by third parties, including email and text messages, internet searches, and bank and credit card records. But Justice Roberts did write that the ruling had limits. Quote, "We hold only that a warrant is required in the rare case where the suspect has a legitimate privacy interest in records held by a third party." The court's four more liberal members, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, joined the opinion. Interesting development on the trade war tariff front. Harley-Davidson to move some production from U.S. because of why? EU tariffs. Imagine that. Harley-Davidson has announced that it is shifting some of the production of its bikes outside of the United States to avoid European Union tariffs imposed as part of a widening trade dispute. This is the first production shift by the automotive motorcycle company in response to the escalating global trade war. Harley-Davidson said on Monday that European Union tariffs on its motorcycles had increased to 31% from 6%. It estimated that the higher tariffs would add about $2,200 on average to every motorcycle exported from the United States to the bloc. So it said it would move the production of bikes bound for Europe outside of the United States. Quote, "Harley-Davidson believes the tremendous cost increase, if passed on to its dealers and retail customers, would have an immediate and lasting detrimental impact to its business in the region, reducing consumer access to Harley-Davidson products and negatively impacting the sustainability of its dealers' businesses." End quote. That's what Harley-Davidson wrote in its filing. Harley-Davidson said the increase in tariffs would cost it an extra $30 million to $45 million for the rest of 2018. It said shifting its production outside the U.S. would take 9 to 18 months. Its facilities in India, Brazil, and Thailand would increase manufacturing so the company could avoid paying tariffs. The company did not say how jobs in the United States would be affected. Argentine workers' union and social movements protest President Morsi's economic policies and reject his government's agreement with the IMF. Argentina's most important workers' unions paralyzed the country today in the third general strike to protest President Morsi's economic policies and to reject an agreement with the International Monetary Fund. There's that IMF again. The national strike called for by the General Confederation of Labor, the CGT, which has around 3 million members, was joined by the Workers' Central Union, CTA, other workers' organizations, and social movements. There will be no transportation nationwide. Air and maritime transport have been brought to a halt. Public schools, banks, and gas stations did not open today. A representative of the CGT said the strike is in response to the veto to the tariffs reduction approved by Congress, the agreement with the IMF, and the consequences they have on employment, public works, social security, the regional economies, and dramatically worsen the already unbearable social situation. It's interesting how what's happening in here in Argentina is very similar to what's happening in Nicaragua. A representative, Argentine workers, they have organized two general strikes before, one in April and one in December of 2017. Despite these actions, Morsi's government has continued to push austerity policies that disproportionately affect the working class, while investors and agribusiness receive economic incentives. This is similar, again, to what's happening in Nicaragua with President Daniel Ortega. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Trump calls for depriving immigrants who illegally cross border of due process rights. Trump says those who cross into the United States illegally should be sent back immediately without due process or an appearance before a judge. What does this mean? Is it a substantive policy proposal or just more mindless chatter that is intended to cloud the issues? Is this a constitutionally defensible position? To get insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He manages a solo practice dedicated exclusively to immigration law. He represents clients with complex family petitions, including VA, WA applications and litigants before the Executive Office for Immigration Review in federal circuit courts. He has authored articles on the immigration consequences of criminal convictions and the Violence Against Women Act for the Maryland Bar, and is a frequent lecturer at national and local conferences on immigration law. Attorney Mark Shmueli, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. And unfortunately, I had to talk last week about how to work with your clients in detention at our national conference. So an ever-changing world.
In fact, you were so gracious with your time last week. We spoke to you from that conference. And here we are now, another week, another issue. So, Mark, Trump says those who cross into the United States illegally should be sent back immediately without due process or with an appearance before a judge. What does this mean? Is it a substantive policy proposal, or is it just more mindless chatter that is intended to cloud the issues?
Well, it's not substantive, and it's an opinion, and as if with no briefing. I mean, but that's the way that he rolls. I mean, that's the way that the president rolls. And often, if there's somebody within the agency that can mold that into a policy, which is usually often very reactionary people, because he seems to be either forcing people like Mattis today, housing children in military detention sites and military bases as detaining them there, or some of the stuff that Tillerson, who were more normative, had to do. Those people often leave to be replaced by the people like Sessions, who are true believers in, I mean, the term white nationalist has been thrown around, but historically, rapid attacks on immigrants have come from the same people who attack blacks and civil rights and Jews. And historically, they're right in that world. And we see the people today that are doing that, and they have their own personal histories there. I mean, it's no secret that the attorney general, who couldn't get confirmed as a federal district judge, the Republican Senate, because he targeted voter registration in African-American areas of Alabama for prosecution, would be the person who's also attacking immigrants.
So by saying that people who come to the country illegally should be sent back immediately without due process, both the Fifth and the 14th Amendments say no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. But is there still some constitutional debate about immigration law being, as I read, more administrative and under the purview of Congress as opposed to civil or criminal law under the purview of the courts? Is that a real distinction that needs to be determined?
It is a real distinction, and there's a little bit of a twist here. And in the last hour, on the last show, there was a guest from Tucson who made the really good point that the United States is unique in criminalizing migration, in that it is a misdemeanor crime. It's never been prosecuted before to cross into the United States without proper documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Entering without inspection or attempting to enter without inspection, which is what, you know, the bulk of people coming through Central America, not just Central Americans, but people who from all over the world who come through Central America, because, you know, really only the privileged or people who are from families here are going to get a visa to enter the United States. So you have people who either come from Europe on a visa waiver or get a visa and overstay, which is still the majority of people who are in the United States without status. And they are treated differently, both by the law and also by that particular law of crossing in that particular misdemeanor criminal statute, which is being enforced against these families. So there is no other way. There is no line. And if people are fleeing the violence in Central America, if people are fleeing the excessive conditions which force them to flee, and this is coupled with, and we talked about it last week, this administration attacking the expansion of persecution. And there are groups by non-governmental actors. Well, these are extremely weak governments, countries that are controlled in many regions by either gangs or paramilitaries. And, they're a country where women are often not protected, and violence against women, and that's one of the categories that the United States is now trying to ban from getting protection here, getting asylum. Make no mistake, this is a extreme intimidation following a mild deterrence. This is put into a level of deterrence that's extreme. And also, I would say, I was thinking about the Constitution, I would say this is also cruel and unusual punishment. And I was thinking about that because we're hearing stories. I'm hearing from some of my colleagues. The mothers are not allowed to speak to their children unless they, everything's so corporatized in any prison now. If we go into it, you can't, you can barely get a roll of toilet paper unless your family pays for it with a fee through a private company. Well, that's the same in any phone call. And so these moms and dads cannot call their children. Don't know where they are until a social worker may contact them. And so the fact that we have to raise money to do that, and this was alerted to me by my colleagues in that have gone to the border, that level of stress would just... The idea is to make it so rough on these people.
Right.
We'll turn around. And there have been stories about them saying, okay, we'll bring you your children if you...
Self-deport.
If you sign an order of removal that you will not that you will not go to court. So that's one way of doing what Trump is saying.
But isn't that, this may be a bit of a stretch, Mark, but isn't that holding the children hostage? If you have a parent in custody and you have taken their children and you say to them, I'll return your children to you if you self-deport, you're holding those children as hostages.
Yes. Now, I've read that. I don't know in a specific case where that happens, but whether that happens specifically, that is what happened when they took them. One of, a colleague of mine, Andrea Rodriguez, did a great report on what she viewed when she was at the last week. And what she was saying was the first day she interviewed these mothers, she couldn't communicate with them that effectively because they were just in a daze because they didn't know where their kids were. They didn't know where New York was, whether New York was next to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and so the next day, once they had been able to speak to their kids through this group of attorneys raising money, then they were able to communicate better. Well, it is really hard to represent a client who's in detention, especially because these detention centers are so remote.
Mm-hmm.
By kicking up by making it that much harder, by putting this level of stress on them, if somebody is going to file a claim for asylum, the deck is stacked against them at the beginning because they have the burden of proving it, and they have to gain this documentation, and they often have to get it from their country, and they really have to work hard on these cases. Well, if you're not present to work on your case because you don't know where your child is, you're not going to be able to do that. If you're sitting in, the fact that people are in a jail like somebody who is harmful to society because they've crossed the border and the view is that they won't come to court, so we have to keep, makes it hard enough. But imagine that after you've taken this journey through Mexico, this really dangerous journey with your kid, the level of exhaustion, the damage to your health,
mm-hmm.
and the fear for your children. You don't know where they're taking them. You know that these men with arms have taken your children from you, and you don't know where they're going. And these are often people who were terrorized before.
Aren't we also here talking about two different classes of people, those who enter illegally looking for work or what they'll call economic refugees versus those who are honestly seeking asylum. It seems as though, as I'm watching some of the major corporate news channels or I'm reading from the corporate media, that they're referring to or they are addressing these issues as though we're talking about one homogenous group of people. But actually, those are two major categories of different types of individuals, correct?
I mean, there are some people that are coming here, no doubt, that may not have fit. They may be afraid the country might be violent, but they may not have the personal story, the personal persecution, to the personal fear of persecution on account of one of the five grounds that gets you asylum. It's like that was the catch-22 with a place like Haiti or Somalia, where you had these completely failed states, but people weren't directly targeted, but, you know, you could be caught in the crossfire.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the reason of, one, you have to expand the definition of asylum.
Okay.
Two, you have to recognize, as everybody's talking about, the role of factors like climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Like climate change.
Like NAFTA and the impact that NAFTA's had on the economy and the fact that these people are now destitute in their own countries because of tariffs on corn and tariffs on other things, and farmers are being decimated and being forced to flee their land.
Right, and there's also just so much history that, you know, is the reason why people are leaving. And, you know, these are fragile economies and fragile societies in a lot of ways, and that could turn on a dime as far as people's safety and ability to eat. And yeah, if people do, I mean, one of the things that's not often talked about is the reaction to the surge of all of the children in 2014 was a very mild version of this. But the Obama administration did ask for an exception to the Flores settlement to be able to detain kids longer because they were overwhelmed, and this was no answer. And
mm-hmm.
The problem is that the lack of answers leads to the crazy, you know, the almost, I mean, goes into a direction, but it's not really a relevant argument that anybody would make except Donald Trump.
A number of members of Congress from both the Senate and the House, from both Republican and Democratic parties, went to the border. They went to a lot of these facilities trying to gain access, trying to view how these children and individuals are being cared for and housed, and they were, in many instances, denied access. You had members of the media who were going in or trying to go in, trying to get footage, trying to get photographs and pictures and interviews. They were denied access. Now what I'm seeing is the government is releasing footage from inside of some of these facilities. That, to me, sounds like propaganda more than honest, unbiased accounting of what's going on in there and who is being viewed or who is being held and how.
Absolutely. And I've seen some of those pictures and the places look nice. And, you know, but on the other hand, there's a lot of money being poured into these prisons. So, I mean, I had a discussion with the sheriff from Frederick County when he was talking about that, when I was on a panel with him, about how nice their prison was. And I said, yeah, it is really nice. You've got a lot of money being put into that. It doesn't matter. If you separate a child from their parents,
you can send them to Disneyland and it won't matter.
Yeah, I mean, the level, there's no way that is going, it's going to matter. And so I don't know what they're trying to accomplish with those pictures or who they're trying to.
Well, I think, Mark, it's a desperate attempt to quell the disturbance that they find themselves dealing with here in this country over this issue. I think that the president believed that because he ran successfully on this issue, that he would be able to take the type of action that he has called for and the type of action that Sessions has implemented, and that he wasn't going to get this backlash. And now that I think he's really been surprised and overwhelmed by the backlash that he's received And now they really don't know how to manage it.
Well, and they're not going to get support from the courts on this. Now, what I, you know, caution people, I mean, this is what my colleagues and I will do, is we'll take these issues to a court, and that's what we do. But I caution people to act as if this is going to matter. Every other president, if there were a court order, they would follow it, not just figure out how to get around it. I mean, he's kind of like a teenager trying to get around parents' rules. And we know that as an individual, he has a history of having zero respect for the judicial system.
Is an example of that the executive order that he signed last week, where one of the elements of it was, I am directing the attorney general to immediately challenge the Flores decision. And then the day after it was signed, Jeff Sessions was trying to get around the Flores decision. Is that an example of what you mean?
That is absolutely an example. And I think it's also the idea. I mean, they are trying both internally, forcing immigration judges to be on schedules and completion goals and all that. And aside, to put this is going to be taken up in international courts. Now, of course, that won't matter. We've pulled out of the International Human Rights Court. It won't matter to them, but cumulatively, it'll keep mattering, because immigration judges are going to have to hear cases. And if they follow what they're saying, what the administration is wanting them to do, they will be overturned at some point, and they don't want that. And there is going to be an implosion and a crisis, because these are people that are going to get their hearing in immigration court, and they're going to get their evidence. There are rules of immigration court. You present your evidence, and even people that are detained, the hearings go more quickly, but you're not going to get anything immediate, and there's already a huge backlog.
In fact, let me see if I can just quickly get to the data. There's a huge backlog, and I was reading that the backlog is really being caused not by an increase in, here we go, this is according to the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. The immigration court's backlog keeps rising. As of the end of May 2018, the number of cases waiting decision reached an all-time high of 714,067. This compares with a backlog of 542,411 at the end of 2017. But what I found interesting here is that it said the pace of court filings has not increased. Filings are running slightly behind that of last year at this time. What appears to be driving the burgeoning backlog is the lengthening time it now takes to schedule hearings and complete proceedings in the face of the court's overcrowded dockets.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's a complete mess. ICE is not prepared in court, so that they often are not ready to challenge. People are showing up without asking for more time, because their attorneys can't negotiate with ICE, so you can't narrow issues down. And judges are not allowed to administratively close cases on their own anymore, which means to just leave them dormant while something else is happening that could help somebody, to get a green card in another way, or to be here and authorized in another way.
Let me interrupt you quickly, if I could, please, and throw in what I was also reading was that what's happening with a lot of these cases is the priority of the current administration has changed, which means cases that were at the top of the docket last year may now be moved to another place, because new concerns by the administration are bringing new cases to the top. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, there. It does make sense, and there is no real rhyme or reason so far. What they're saying is that there are no priorities. There was a memorandum from the there were a couple of them during the Obama administration where they prioritized who would be removable, and now that what they're saying is everybody be scared. And our system isn't, you can't do what they're doing in a democracy. You just can't.
Got it.
Bottom line. And people need to realize that you cannot jail children in a democracy. You cannot jail refugees like that in a democracy. And you can't you can't do that. And I think Kamala Harris made the point today that ICE as in that entire agency needs to be revamped and completely different, because they're basically running on defensiveness now, and that's defensiveness, you know, for these policies. And there's the enforcement. You're just not going to enforce that way without violating all kinds of rights left and right, which is what they're doing.
Attorney Mark Shmueli, thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for your time. And as always, man, thank you for coming on the Critical Hour.
Absolutely. Have a great one.
Thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's a lot more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Supreme Court just ruled against warrantless cell phone tracking. Score one for the Constitution. Quote, the government can no longer claim that just using technology like your cell phones means you've given up your Fourth Amendment rights, according to the ACLU. What does this mean for civil liberties? To get insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's a president and founder of the Transformative Justice Coalition. She's internationally renowned for contributions on criminal justice issues, including the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1991 and the 2006 reauthorization of provisions of the Voting Rights Act. She's a board vice chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty and serves on the board of directors of Moms Rising and Independent Sector. She is attorney Barbara Arnwine. Greetings, Barbara, and welcome to the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Barbara, what was this case about, and what does the Roberts decision tell us, if anything, about where the court is on civil liberties?
Well, this is kind of what I called a unique carve-out that the Supreme Court has set for itself. You know, as a general matter, the court has not been favorable to civil liberties claims, and they have been very adverse, drawing some really strong dissent from Sotomayor on the Fourth Amendment, on, you know, questions of search and seizures. They've been very, you know, liberal towards, you know, police power, you know, and so they have not generally been a court that you would call a good civil liberties court.
To that point, hasn't the court been going in that direction ever since the Warren Court, after the Warren Court?
It's gotten worse.
Absolutely. My point is, one of the most liberal, if not the most liberal courts, was the Warren Court. And then ever since then, we've been taking steps backwards. And now with the Roberts Court, we've been taking giant leaps backwards.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's when you come to the First Amendment and technology, all of a sudden, this court is different. And it's interesting that I've been trying to figure out, you know, ideologically, what is driving the court to really try to protect cell phone privacy, because they really have, in their last number of decisions where they've had to take on these issues, have come on the side, have decided on the side of individual rights, and have basically, you know, really denied the government the power to intrude upon, you know, the privacy that is contained within your conversations on cell phone technology. You know, I can't figure it out. I mean, I don't see any rhyme or reason in their decisions that leads you to believe there's an ideological abhorrence of governmental intrusion.
You know what, Barbara? Maybe it's not that deep. Maybe it's as simple as, on voting issues, John Roberts being white and not ever having had a problem voting doesn't get it. But John Roberts and his kids and his family, they use a cell phone every day.
Right. Well, you know, it's a difference between what I always tell people, civil liberties, right, and civil rights. But still, they have not been a great civil liberties court.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think is, like you said, what's really going on here probably is their own reality. That somewhere in their own practice, in their own lives, before people really realized how ubiquitous and how pervasive the use of cell phones would become, how much social media would become popular, that somehow they are aware of people who have made major faux pas, major mistakes, and that they have decided in their hindsight to protect that conduct. And I agree with you, it's very personal. I do not believe this is ideologically driven at all. And it's certainly not a fear of police power or state power. They are absolutely being driven by some unique concern about personal use and personal protection.
Now, the ACLU, who represented the petitioner, they called this a historic win, and that they predicted it'll have a ripple effect for privacy. Do you see it being that far-reaching, or, to your point, a carve-out? And when we get to the next issue dealing with privacy, we may be right back in the same boat we've been in with for the last 30 years, moving further to the right.
I believe this is a special carve-out area for
mm-hmm.
me. I really wish I could be as emboldened as the ACLU to say that this will have, you know, manifold ripple effects moving forward. I just don't see it, not with this court. You know, I just believe that this is a very peculiar area of the law where they're not willing to go as far as they have in search and seizures and other areas. So I do think this is a very unique set of cases, and we will see, just like, you know, we have, you know, these very special, you know, cases on, you know, First Amendment dealing with, you know, hate speech. You know, there's just, you know, a few little places like RAV where they were unwilling to go where they normally would have of having, you know, just an expansive, unlimited intrusion on the First Amendment. So I think you have to view this as, you know, sui generis when you look at all the other cases that they're deciding.
Now, Roberts wrote in this decision that the Constitution must take account for vast technological changes, noting that digital data can provide a comprehensive, detailed, and intrusive overview of private affairs that would have been impossible to imagine not long ago. That took me back to Earl Warren's statement, it is the spirit and not the form of law that keeps justice alive. Does Robert's statement give us insight into the strict constructionist versus what I call the contextualist versus the contextualist? Because I put Robert's position here in this court, I mean, in this case here, in the contextualist camp. He's saying that we have to look at the Constitution in a different context, because when it was written, this technology could not even be imagined.
And that is so unique. Again, I mean, this is so different, because think about it. The originalists,
mm-hmm.
the original intent is what governs the Constitution, no matter what. That, you know, the founding fathers, quote and unquote, so prescient
mm-hmm.
That anything that could be imagined, they covered somehow in the Constitution. Well, the reality is that they didn't, and we know that there were many shortcomings, and it's rare for an originist court, which is what this court has been
mm-hmm.
years.
That's exactly my point.
We go into being contextual, right? It's very different, and it is, that's why I say that this is, to me, you know, in many respects, a special, you know, carve out from their normal reasoning.
I hate to keep beating this, but I'm such an Earl Warren fan. that, and I think you would agree, I have good reason to be. When you look at the Warren Court, that's how we got the Miranda decision. I think that's how we got the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, that proceeds from illegal searches could not be admitted in court. That's how we got...
Or how incriminating, right.
Yeah, that's how we got the... in state court, you are to be granted counsel at no expense. I mean, there were so many decisions that came out of the Warren Court that were pro-civil rights, we got the Brown decision out of the Warren Court. And that ever since then, Berger, Rehnquist, and so on and so forth, the courts have been chipping away at those rights. And I just wanted you to elaborate a little bit more on how now we are seeing such a broad leap away from where we were with protecting civil rights and civil liberties to what we are forced to deal with now. And how dangerous is that?
Well, I think we're in a very dangerous age. I mean, first of all, you know, just to close the discussion about, you know, the First Amendment, about the Fourth Amendment and, you know, phone searches, the privacy, the Tenth Amendment. I think that what people need to understand is this is a rare omission by the court, that there is an area of law that is more expansive, more advanced, unperceived, that when we were dealing with warrants, when we were talking about people entering what? Entering property.
Mm-hmm.
Entering, you know, people who being able to, you know, intercept, you know, publications, writings. The idea of wireless technology was just not there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was such an unperceived area. And remember, for people who really want to understand how difficult this is, go take yourself back a few months ago to the Facebook hearings were held in the Senate and in the, you know, in the House.
Right, right.
Remember how the senators and congresspeople struggled to even grasp and articulate accurately what the technology was.
You had members of the House and of the Senate asking Zuckerberg questions, and they didn't even understand the technology and what Facebook could do.
Exactly. It was embarrassing. And, you know, and I think that that's the reality, that this is how the kind of era we're in, where there are these kinds of technological advances being made. And it is a rare mission by the court, but I still think it's because somewhere in somebody's past on that court, somebody made some terrible, you know, admissions without understanding how openly technology can be sourced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing really is private. People make a mistake. I just laugh about it all the time. People say, oh, I'm not going to join Facebook or social media because I don't want to, all my stuff, you know, publicly, and the Russians are going to get it. And people don't understand that at this point in history, at this point with technology, nothing's private.
Let's shift gears a little bit. There was another decision today. The Supreme Court sends case on North Carolina gerrymandering back to a lower court. The Supreme Court today sent back to a lower court a decision that Republicans in North Carolina had gerrymandered the state's congressional districts to give their party an unfair advantage. Now the lower court will need to decide whether the plaintiffs had the proper legal standing to bring the case. The court recently considered the question of partisan gerrymandering in cases from Wisconsin and Maryland. I think there's a Texas case as well. The court has never found a map so infected by politics that it violated the constitutional rights of voters. What's going on here, Barbara? Where what do you think that there's a message being sent here, and what do you think the message is?
Well, actually, they came out with two cases today. That infected, you know, redistricting and gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm.
They decided the Texas case.
Yeah, that's what I said. There was a Texas case as well, yes.
And they decided the North Carolina case, Brucho, you know, versus Common Cause. And in the cases, you know, raised different issues. The Texas case which is probably the more severe of the two, the a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and that this was a case involving voter dilution where the state of Texas had been found in 2012 to have engaged in intentional discrimination by purposefully drawing districts to exclude and dilute the power of Latino voters and also the power of Black voters. And, of course, you know, when you look at the big urban centers in Texas, you're looking very heavily at Dallas and you're looking very heavily in the Houston area, the Fort Worth area. Those are your big ones. And these cases, of course, came focused on those areas, especially, you know, especially Fort Worth and Dallas. And what happened is that the court, in a 5-4 decision, 5-4 meaning the five conservatives one way and the four, quote, liberals going the other way, and a decision written by Samuel Alito, they basically reversed in large part and affirmed in a small part the lower court's decision, and that they said that there was not enough evidence for the court to have made a finding of intentional discrimination, and that I love this, that the state of Texas had the right to, quote, clean up, that they should be presumed to have the ability to clean up their prior misdeeds by having engaged in intentional discrimination, and that the taint of their prior action should not be imputed until their new map. Now, what was deep here is something we lawyers fight about all the time, was that when the court invalidated their map and said it was a, that it was both too racially gerrymandered and that it also was a an unlawful, violation of the Constitution because of intentional discrimination and animus towards, people of color. When the court did that, it decided something that's rare, which is, does it then redraw the map? And how does it redraw the map? So what the court did was it adopted its own interim map. And you always have to be careful when you're a lawyer about these interim maps and interim procedures, because oftentimes interim means that it's incomplete.
Right.
That it's just something to hold.
It's temporary.
Something temporary for it not to become worse, not to allow something to become worse. Well, Texas, being the kind of people they are in that state legislature, which is notorious for, voter suppression. They, after the election was over where the interim map was used, they said, well, we're just going to adopt the interim map because we're not going to get anything better than this, and we certainly could get a lot worse. So they adopted the interim map, and what the Supreme Court said today is that that was fine. The court had, was able to tolerate the interim map. Certainly the states adopting it should be legal. And, of course, that's playing, what, flim-flam?
Right.
A game of cards to hide the real intent here. So I thought it was, terrible. They did, they did agree with the court that one of the districts was clearly so badly drawn that it was, in fact, a racial gerrymander, and where they had what we call packing.
Yes.
There's two things they do in these redistricting. You either pack
or stack
into this, or you pack or stack, or you crack. And, pack is where you just take everybody and put them in one little district. It's where you take them where they could have power in a district and you divide that power and throw, in many ways to make it powerless. So this was, these were cases basically of massive packing. So that's a troubling decision. Troubling on many grounds when you start looking at intent, how you define intent, and also what is really troubling is that Gorsuch, the new Justice Gorsuch, appointed by Donald Trump, he said in his concurrence that he believes that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act was never designed to address redistricting. Yes, it was never designed to address redistricting, period.
Then what was it designed for?
Right. You know, I mean, there's only two forms of voting rights discrimination. There's voter denial, where you absolutely say, you know, you just can't vote because you're Black and Latino, and you do it in all kind of hidden ways, but basically you are denying that group the right to vote. And then there's voter dilution, where you're basically saying, well, we're going to take the power that these people of color would have as voters, and we're going to strange district, do everything we can to dilute that power to make sure that they never can elect the candidate of their choice. And those two forms of voter voting discrimination, has been recognized by the court since the inception of the Voting Rights Act. With the voter dilution, you know, growing in power over the years, and then all of a sudden, of course, with this new wave of voter suppression, all of a sudden you have voter denial cases back.
Let me ask you this. In the Wisconsin case, the court punted it back to Wisconsin. In the Maryland case, the court punted it back to Maryland. In the Ohio case, I think they punted back to Ohio. And now in the North Carolina case, they punted the case back to the lower court in North Carolina. What do you think is their intent? Is there a message here as it relates to the possible retirement of Justice Kennedy? Why are they doing this?
Well, there's a couple of things going on that people need to pay good attention to. One is that in Gill versus Whitford, underreported by the media, was that the court said that this was a standing case. County for which they sent it back, they said that you needed to prove county by county that the state had done something wrong instead of attacking the entire map. Well, that means if you do a county by county jurisprudence where you got to file these cases one by one by one, and you got states with 100 counties, 50 counties, that's just going to take away the power fight voter discrimination, voting rights discrimination.
Didn't that also kind of fly in the face of the reality, as though
very decisive. Flies in the face of precedent. The story decisive
makes it almost as though class action suits don't exist.
It makes it difficult, you know, on a statewide basis. So it really does weaken the hands of those who are trying to challenge discrimination. And I tried to point that out to people, that that case was not just a punt, that it actually really was actually pretending a new, very difficult set of standards. And that's precisely what they said in North Carolina. I think this to be considered based on our standing findings.
So we have just about a minute. Do you think also, though, with the possible retirement of Kennedy, that they're playing around with their decisions?
No doubt about it. This is all waiting for the next Trump justice to be appointed, that they believe that they have the vote. And people got to be clear, it's not just these technical issues of redistricting, of other violations, but they want to undo the entire Voting Rights Act.
I got to stop you there. Barbara Arnwine, thank you so much for your time this evening. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all tomorrow right here on Radio Sputnik.